The Phoenix City Council is meeting this hour to decide its next step in the controversy over new airline flight paths. That step could be a lawsuit.
It is now apparent that the FAA has zero intent of solving serious noise issues that affect so many of our neighborhoods in Phoenix.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a Flagstaff group tries to take back control of the minimum wage. Scientists try to figure out why there's so much methane around the Four Corners.
And get ready to alter your sense of time and space.
We're saying, well, maybe some of that accelerating universe isn't accelerating at all. It's dust that you haven't accounted for.
Plus, a new film festival sprouts up in the West Valley and a traveling celebration of Latino musicians.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley traffic at this hour, a couple of accidents in the same neck of the woods, I-10 westbound at 83rd Avenue and also at 67th Avenue. In that case, the HOV lane is blocked. We're looking for clear skies tonight around the valley. Overnight lows only in the lower 50s. We did, in fact, cool off quite a bit today, as forecasters had proposed. It's sunny and 70 degrees.
Officials on the Navajo Nation have signed a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Department of the Interior approving the federal land buyback program. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, it's the latest tribe to participate in the federal program.
The goal of the program is to reduce what's known as fractionation, or the amount of land within tribal boundaries that's individually owned. The land sold through the buyback is held in trust for each tribe, which essentially turns it into official reservation land. Deswood Tome is with the Navajo Nation President's Office. He says one reason the tribe entered the agreement was to reduce uncertainty as groups in surrounding states begin to push Congress to transfer federal public land back to state control.
Navajo Nation always believes that land is important and land is inherent in our sovereignty and in our language and our culture, and that they are all inextricable.
Officials say the Navajo Nation has almost 34,000 individual landowners. The cost to cover those land interests is estimated at more than $100 million. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This week, the Federal Aviation Administration released a report with possible adjustments to new flight paths over Phoenix. The agency made those changes last September as part of a nationwide update called NextGen. The new flight paths have increased noise levels over central Phoenix neighborhoods and angered many residents. The city has appointed representatives to work with the FAA to come up with a solution. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan has been following the issue and was at the city's press conference yesterday, and she joins me now. So, Alex, what did the report say?
Well, Steve, I'm actually going to quote from the letter. The letter said, the FAA provided 14 alternatives to the Phoenix representatives and expected the city would offer its own suggestions, which did not happen. We strongly believe the city needs to consider alternatives other than just returning to previous flight paths. Now, the city was very angry because it was accusatory and it accused the representatives that were on this council that was supposed to work with the FAA of not contributing. So most of what they said in yesterday's press conference was kind of discrediting the claim the FAA made in that letter yesterday. So Mayor Stanton said this in the press conference.
We believe that they rejected offhand, as was you can see in the letter, the number of alternatives that they rejected. We believe that they rejected those way too quickly and didn't do thorough enough analysis, solutions that would have had much more significant relief for the people of our community.
Now, the city wants the FAA to go back to the old flight path prior to September of 2014, but the FAA doesn't want to do that. So it's this battle of, we want you to go back. Well, we can't do that. We need to come up with a new solution.
Okay, so what are the possible suggested changes?
So the letter also says that one possible solution would be reducing aircraft speeds and increasing rates of climb. But then the letter qualifies that by saying it could potentially decrease noise levels, which people aren't so happy with. They want to reduce the noise levels, not potentially do that. So this potential solution could be problematic for other reasons, too, because at a previous Phoenix City Council meeting in December, the FAA Regional Administrator Glenn Martin said these options may not be as safe as the other way.
I think it's relatively safe to say higher is most likely to have less noise impact on the ground. However, the difficulty in that is you're at a critical stage of flight taking off, and safety is probably the biggest concern we have with coming up with some way for them to ascend quicker.
So the city is not happy with the suggested changes, and they want to continue other ways and find new changes.
And you heard there are some possibilities. The city is really not taking anything off the table. What could it do?
That will be decided in a meeting later today, actually shortly. But yesterday, Mayor Stanton said the city is preparing to sue. But residents say, bottom line, we want the noise fixed. We don't care how you do it. Just fix it. Steve Dreisesen lives in one of the affected neighborhoods in central Phoenix, and he doesn't know if legal action would be the best way to solve the problem quickly.
The best solution is a solution that's worked out among the parties. Anything that would be forced by legal action would certainly take much longer. There is no guarantee of success. I think we can affect change without having to go to drastic measures. We certainly want to make a calculated decision, not an emotional one.
Mayor Stanton and the council members also said they're going to do things simultaneously while considering this option to sue. They said they might work with other cities' airports that have been affected by these flight path changes. And Stanton also said he wants to try and work with individual airlines that fly in and out of Sky Harbor to work on possible voluntary solutions, although I'm not really sure how much control the airlines have or what that would exactly mean.
KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan with the latest on flight paths. Alex, thanks.
Thanks.
A group in Flagstaff has filed a lawsuit challenging a 2013 Arizona law which banned cities and towns in the state from setting their own minimum wages higher than the state's. Arizona's minimum wage was approved by voters in 2006 and currently stands at $8.05 an hour. Joe Bader is a member of the Flagstaff Living Wage Coalition, which filed the suit.
What we're looking to do is assert local control, which is reflects the will of the voters as they expressed in 2006. When they voted to raise the state minimum wage, and in that initiative, there was clear language that allowed cities and counties to establish their own wages and benefits as long as they were higher than the state minimum wage.
Do you think that Flagstaff should be setting a minimum wage that's higher than the state one?
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes, I do, definitely. Well, Flagstaff is, according to a recent study, the wages in Flagstaff are lower than any metropolitan area in the country when you consider the cost of living. It's harder to live in Flagstaff if you're poor than it is in any other city in the country.
What do you make of arguments that say that raising the minimum wage will actually cost jobs, that there will be fewer of those sort of low-wage jobs available in a given locality?
Most of the studies that have been done in the last, I'd say, 5 years have actually established that there was little to no impact, adverse impact on employment when there's modest increases to the minimum wage. So, and I think besides the studies that have been done showing that in recent years, we can just look at empirical evidence. You can look around at different cities around the country that have raised their minimum wage, and there's no evidence in those cities that people, that businesses are failing, or that the unemployment rate is going up.
What would you like to see Flagstaff's minimum wage be set at?
Well, we're going to be talking to low-wage workers in the community and small businesses to talk it out and figure out what an appropriate wage would be for this city, which is a very expensive place to live.
The law that you're trying to basically overturn was passed in 2013, so why did it take you this long to get this lawsuit filed?
I think the reason is that in recent, very, very recently, the issue of income inequality and the wages that have been flat in this country for the last 30 years got a lot of attention. So, I mean, that's a topical issue. So we started to look around and research in Arizona what we can do. And we realize that the voters have already decided. They already decided that this is a power that cities have. And so we decided to talk to some smart attorneys that took a look at it, and they agreed that it's something that is actually a pretty clear case of two conflicting laws, and the voter initiative takes precedence over any act of the state legislature.
Joe Bader is a member of the Flagstaff Living Wage Coalition, which has filed a lawsuit arguing a 2013 state law that stops cities and towns from setting their own minimum wages is illegal. But Jeffrey Myron thinks minimum wages in general are a bad idea. He's a senior lecturer in economics and director of undergraduate studies in the economics department at Harvard. He's also the director of economic studies at the D.C.-based Cato Institute. Myron believes minimum wages increase pay for workers who keep their jobs, but generally reduce jobs for low-skilled workers.
the magnitude of the employment losses depends on how high the minimum wage is and on how much it's raised. Small changes or a low minimum wage will have very small effects. Bigger minimum wages and bigger changes will have bigger effects.
In your mind, should there be a floor that wages have to be either at or above?
I don't think that government policy should be taking any stand at all on what the level of wages is at any level. I think it should let the market determine that, because that way we get the most efficient allocations of what kinds of low-skilled, medium-skilled, high-skilled labor or capital are used in the production processes of different firms. If there's desire to redistribute income, I think there are policies which redistribute income toward people who have low incomes much more effectively than the minimum wage does.
I'm curious about when you say government shouldn't set this kind of policy, because in Arizona, I guess you could argue it's a government-set policy, but it was enacted by voters who agreed several years ago to institute a minimum wage. Does that sort of fall under the category of government not being able to or shouldn't be setting this kind of policy?
In my view, it certainly would, because the voters have created a new policy that will be enforced by the government. Firms which do not comply with the new rule created by the voters will be subject to penalties of various kinds if they don't comply. That's very different than, say, Walmart deciding that it wants to pay its low-wage workers a higher wage. That, of course, is entirely between Walmart and its employees.
Based on your argument that government shouldn't be setting this policy, do you think it follows then that government shouldn't be setting policy, state governments, that cities and towns can't make this policy? Or do you think it's okay that, for example, a state like Arizona could say, cities and towns, you can't do this?
The damage that's done by having a government set a minimum wage is worse the higher the level of government. If, for example, the federal government does that and makes every state, every city, town, every employer throughout the country, I think there's potential for significant damage. If the federal government does nothing and each state is left to set its own minimum wage or not, there will still be, in my view, some negative effects, but they're moderated by the fact that each state thinks to itself, if I set too high a minimum wage, a bunch of businesses are going to leave and go to a neighboring state, so there will still perhaps be some minimum wages, but they won't get elevated as much. And extending that logic, if a state says there's no state-mandated minimum wage, each city is allowed to set a minimum wage if it likes, most cities will hesitate to set too high a minimum wage because they know they would drive business to other cities within the same state.
Do you think it's appropriate for the state to be telling its cities that they cannot set a minimum wage for themselves?
So my answer on that might sound a little inconsistent, but my position is the state should not make any policy that prevents cities from setting a minimum wage, even though I would not want my city to set a minimum wage. And my reasoning is I think that the lower the level of government at which policies are set, the less damage they do, and it's good to, as consistently as possible, say that the higher levels of government simply stay uninvolved and let lower levels of government make their own decisions. So I would extend that to this situation. The state of Arizona should let cities choose to have a minimum wage, but if I were a resident of, say, Phoenix, Arizona, I would vote against Phoenix having a minimum wage.
Jeffrey Myron is Director of Economic Studies at the Cato Institute and Senior Lecturer in Economics at Harvard. Last week, we spoke with Arizona Republic investigative reporter Craig Harris, who wrote a story about the payout given to the founder of the charity Celebrity Fight Night, Jimmy Walker. Earlier this week, GoDaddy founder Bob Parsons said he'd give the organization $1 million a year over 5 years to cover Walker's salary. For more on this, we turn to Dr. Abraham Lieberman, director of the Muhammad Ali Parkinson Center at Barrow Neurological Institute, one of Celebrity Fight Night's beneficiaries.
Jimmy's commitment is a very deep commitment. About 3 or 4 years ago, he called me and he said, you know, I've never taken a salary for this, but this is taking more and more work, and the board proposed that they pay me a salary. I had assumed, given the amount of work he did, because he is Celebrity Fight Night, that he was being paid a salary. The amount of work he does is enormous.
Why do you think it is that prior to recently, he wasn't getting paid?
Because Jimmy was doing other work for charities. He was not taking the amount of time the event kept on growing bigger and bigger. In the beginning, it was a small event. It has now become one of the major recognized charities in the country. And it started to impact on his business because he was spending so much time on this event. I mean, without Jimmy Walker, there is no Celebrity Fight Night.
What led to the decision to basically write a letter to sort of counteract the reporting that was done by Craig Harris at the Arizona Republic? You were one of the signatories on that letter. It sounded like the three of you thought that the story was a little bit unfair, and I'm wondering why you think that.
Well, I think the implication said nothing about what the work of the charity was. The implication was, gotcha. Organizer of charity, making big money from charity.
Do you think the way that the payout was handled could have been handled differently? I mean, I know that supporters of Mr. Walker's have said, look, this is not a lot of money when you amortize it over the amount of time that he's been doing this for free. But when you look at sort of the number on its own, it's a pretty big number, especially coming from a charity. So I'm wondering if you think that some aspect of this maybe could have been done slightly differently.
Look, you can always go back in retrospect and say, well, we should have done this, we should have done this. Well, first of all, we should have been paying Jimmy all along. That was a mistake. I mean, Jimmy should have been drawing his salary all along, and no one would have been critical of it. Some people question this. But that's the way the world works. I mean, you want an incompetent to run your charity? Yeah, I guess in retrospect. But all of this was this is a public charity, so there was no subterfuge. They said this is a bonus paid to you based on your previous work.
Dr. Abraham Lieberman is director of the Muhammad Ali Parkinson Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. Dr. Lieberman, thank you so much.
And thank you.
Still to come, a new exhibit in Phoenix looks to retell the story of Latinos in American popular music.
It's an exhibit about Latino music, but I think a lot of people don't think of hip-hop as a Latino music, right? So we're trying to change that.
Find out how. It's the show.
Good Thursday afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's the show on 91.5 to the Valley Freeways. Couple of accidents to watch out for, both on I-10 westbound. One at 67th Avenue, that one's blocking the HOV lane. The other at 83rd Avenue, which is blocking the right lane. Valley weather for tonight, look for clear skies, overnight lows in the lower to mid-50s. Should be sunny, a little bit warmer for tomorrow with a high of 82, and then this weekend back above normal, with highs in the lower 90s under sunny skies. And current weather conditions around the state include partly cloudy and 41 degrees at the Grand Canyon. Clear skies and only 54 in Prescott. Tucson with fair skies and 68 degrees. Here in the valley with relative humidity at 8%, we are more than 10 degrees below normal. Clear skies and 72 at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business presenting the Economic Outlook Luncheon on May 6th. Economists will discuss the local and national economy and the 2016 forecast. Registration at econclubphx.org.
The minimum wage is going up in some areas of the U.S., and just yesterday, fast food workers across the country were involved in protests as part of the fight for $15 to get higher salaries for lower wage workers. Here in Arizona, exotic dancers are suing Three Valley strip clubs for alleged unpaid tips and wages. At those clubs, the dancers are not employees. They're independent contractors. Ross Eisenbray is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. He says misclassifying workers is a significant problem.
Companies have a huge incentive to basically defraud their state government and the federal government and their workers by treating them not as employees, but as independent contractors. When they do that, they don't have to pay workers' compensation premiums. They don't have to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. They don't pay unemployment insurance taxes. And then they're also not covered for overtime. If it's not an employee, you don't have to pay them time and a half when they work overtime. And this is important, particularly in these cases of strippers and exotic dancers, their tips can be shared with the management, whereas a tipped worker who is covered by the minimum wage law, is covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act, their tips can only be shared with other tipped workers.
When it comes to exotic dancers in strip clubs, is there a feeling that there's a perception that either based on pop culture or based on the fact that perhaps many people look down their noses at exotic dancers, that the feeling is, well, you know, they either sort of know what they're getting into, or the perception is, well, they're really doing great. I mean, even if they have to share with their management, they've got a lot to share because they're probably all driving fancy cars and whatnot.
Both of those perceptions, I think, are fairly widespread. But when you follow the cases, as I have, and you see the recoveries that the workers are getting, some of them are pretty eye-opening. There are cases in New York. Believe it or not, there's a club that has 1,200 dancers, and they recently settled for $8 million in back wages. A club in California settled for almost $13 million in back wages. So clearly the workers can benefit by being treated as employees. I mean, we see pictures in movies and TV of people stuffing money into the stockings of the women or into their garters or something, but they're not taking it all home. The management is taking most of it.
Because of that industry, is less attention paid to it?
The strip club problem is a more recent problem, or at least the dancers have become aware of the law. But this problem of misclassifying employees, treating employees as independent contractors to avoid all these obligations, it's something that's been going on for years, but getting worse and worse with each passing year, because we have fewer labor inspectors, and the IRS, I don't know whether you've noticed, has had its budget cut by hundreds of millions of dollars,
mm-hmm.
and they have far fewer investigators to go after the businesses that are cheating.
Do potential workers need to take more responsibility for knowing more about what job they're taking, or is the deck stacked against them?
I can't think of anybody except for unions, and of course they're dwindling, who organizes workers, tells them about their rights, advocates for them. I mean, who else is going to do that? I'd like to see these things taught in high school so that when people graduate from high school, they have a better understanding of labor law and what's at stake and what the employment relationship is all about, but I don't see that happening.
Ross Eisenbray is Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute.
The new state budget Governor Doug Ducey signed into law earlier this year included millions of dollars in spending cuts. About $1 million worth of those cuts was to the Arizona Commission on the Arts, which, among other things, deals with grants to arts organizations.
In a letter, the commission's executive director wrote its funding could hit a 30-year low and that he plans to, quote, map out a bold way forward for Arizona's arts sector.
For a look at how those cuts may affect a Valley Arts group that gets grants from the commission, we turn to David Hempfill, executive director of Black Theater Troupe.
Shocking to hear about the drastic cuts in funding. $1 million, it's a lot of money. It makes a big difference to groups like ours. Now, the funding comes, and it's directly related or relative to the size of your organization and your organization's budget. So the larger organizations, you know, they have a better cushion than some of the smaller organizations like ours. Funding from the commission was enough to provide some essential items, essential services for our organization. It helped alleviate the costs of instructional materials for our children's program. It helped alleviate the cost of any particular show that we wanted to add some more production values to, as in rent a certain piece of equipment or something like that. It allowed us to do that. And most importantly, before the major cuts came along, that money was actually used for consultants for our children's programs.
Do you have a sense of how much money Black Theater Troupe stands to lose?
In comparison to previous funding years, we stand to lose maybe $10,000.
And how big a deal is that in the scope of your overall operating budget?
Well, it's a big deal. Now, fortunately enough, we've been able to somewhat revise our budgets and cut corners here and there as a result of the economic downturn and the first cuts that were initiated by through the commission. So we're kind of used to it. Last season, we got maybe $5,000, which wasn't a lot of money, but it was still instrumental and very, very important to augment our budget.
So what does that mean that you won't be able to do or won't be able to have?
Well, it was an important part of our budget in the sense that it allowed us to do additional things that we hadn't budgeted for. Next season, without the funding, it's going to be a real challenge because we moved into a new building in February 2013, and we'd use some of those monies to offset some of the utility costs. Funding from the commission would pay our water bill for a year.
David Hemphill is the executive director of Black Theater Troupe in Phoenix.
Local musician Margot Reed passed away yesterday at the age of 73. She was known for her deep, stirring voice that marked the jazz, blues, and gospel music she performed for decades. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has more.
Reed is probably best known for her work with the Reed family. Her sister Francine Reed has received a lot of notoriety, but local musicians and fans will tell you there was just something about Margot's voice. Here's Bob Corator, host of KJZZ's Those Lowdown Blues.
Margot had this almost supernatural quality about her vocal. She was able to take any song, be it a ballad, blues, a jazz number. She could take any of those types of songs and make them this soul-wrenching experience.
I want a little sugar.
Reed moved to Arizona in 1973 and began working as a hotel housekeeper. Shortly after, she sat in on a set at the Century Sky Room, a now-closed jazz and blues club, and was hired to perform regularly, which was not surprising to Patricia Myers, a jazz music journalist and former manager for Margot Reed.
She is memorable. She's unforgettable. She's almost indescribable. But you know Margot from the first note that comes out of her mouth.
Why should I feel discouraged? Why?
Reed is a member of the Arizona Blues Hall of Fame, and along with the Reed family, is also a member of the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
And long for heaven and home. When Jesus is my portion, my constant.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city. 5, 8, 4, 4, 6.
Thank you.
We're at the Harmon Library. We're a great little neighborhood library where you walk in and you're going to be greeted with a smile. The kids know that if I'm doing a program, we're doing Legos.
Whoa! Look at me.
We have created cities. We create superheroes. I like to think I'm the Lego master.
Is this a beach house?
Yeah.
Are you going to make a patio, too?
Can I see?
Once again, story time is about to begin.
Okay, are you ready? Let's pretend. Can somebody do Ribbit for me?
Ribbit?
You can do it.
I think the kids know coming to the library is not going to be the traditional library experience.
Now you're going to give Miss Anna your name.
And they know it's a place to go when they might not have anything else to do.
Doors! Yeah, doors!
That was Stephanie Martinez, Anna Coelho, and Randall's Lunsford at the Phoenix Public Library's Harmon Branch. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us we're overdue, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. Accidents I-10 westbound at 75th Avenue. Also at 83rd Avenue, that latter accident blocks the right lane. Currently under sunny skies, we're way below normal. It's 72 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Holland America Line, offering 7 and 14-day Alaska cruises sailing round-trip from Seattle, departing May through September. Information is available through a travel professional or at hollandamerica.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Militants with the self-proclaimed Islamic State have battled security forces inside Iraq's largest oil refinery today, and they're closing in on the city of Ramadi, where hundreds fled their homes today. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is emphasizing that the militants remain, in his words, very, very dangerous. Abadi is in Washington today, and NPR's Greg Myers says he's been asking for better coordination between the U.S. and Iraq in fighting the Islamic State group.
The Iraqi Prime Minister said he didn't have any specific requests for the United States in terms of hardware, nothing new, but he did have something in particular when it came to the U.S. airstrikes. He said Iraq is working with the Americans and offering targeting information, but it was taking too long for the Americans to carry out those strikes.
That's NPR's Greg Meyer. Key lawmakers from both parties say they have reached a deal to allow President Obama to negotiate trade deals that could not be amended but subject only to an up or down vote from Congress. That so-called fast-track legislation comes as Obama is seeking a trade deal with 11 Pacific nations. Labor unions say that Pacific Pact would hurt U.S. job growth and encourage other countries to abuse workers and the environment, but the administration is rejecting those claims. The head of the International Monetary Fund is indicating that she will not grant Greece a payment delay on its repayments to the IMF.
It's clearly not a course of action that would actually fit or be recommendable in the current situation. We have never had an advanced economy asking for payment delays.
That's IMF head Christine Lagarde. Growing concerns that Greece might default on its debt have sent its cost of borrowing sharply higher today. On Wall Street, stock prices barely budged. The Dow closed down 6 points. The Nasdaq was off 3 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Scientists know that the devastating effects of Alzheimer's disease come in part from the brain declaring war on itself. Certain proteins and amino acids trigger genes to switch on, and that causes a chain reaction where immune cells attack a vital nutrient in the brain that thereby degrades memory function.
In tests in mice, researchers have been able to interrupt this cycle, which suggests possible human tests. For more, we turn to Carol Colton, professor of neurology at Duke University and the senior author of the new study. She says the key is understanding how the immune system reacts to Alzheimer's disease.
There's a response, and the response is basically a warrior response where they're defensive, they fight off bacteria, virus, that's a really good thing. And then there's another response to microglia or immune cells in the brain, and that is the nurturer, where it helps the brain survive, it helps the brain repair and maintain. So it's easy to see that the warrior would be a component of Alzheimer's disease. It's hard to understand that the nurturer could be a problem in Alzheimer's disease. But what our study shows is that, in fact, the nurturer here is a problem.
How similar is this to something like PKU, which in babies is a problem of non-metabolized amino acids, phenylalanine, I believe, that causes huge sorts of problems as the brain essentially becomes the enemy of itself and produces severe mental retardation?
Amino acids for infants and children are very critical. The amino acid arginine is absolutely essential for young children, for the development of the brain, et cetera. And so you have to maintain a good balance of all of normal amino acids. But we're talking about a disease state where now the immune cell, our microglia, is actually saying, I'm unhappy, the brain is unhappy, and I'm going to try to fix it. So this concept of the nurturer, and by the way, I have to shout out to Joe Alcore from Harvard for that terminology. I think it's really very good terminology. But anyway, to make the long story short, then the nurturer says, I have to do this, I have to turn on this side of the system, and when that happens, It's just a consequence of overactivity of the system in a confined space.
What's the therapeutic option here, and what might be the first step to actually trying something on humans?
Yeah, well, you know, it would be great if I could say, oh, my goodness, we should just be able to consume lots of arginine and fix that problem, right? And I don't want to make that impression that that could be true. In reality, you can consume a lot of different types of metabolites, arginine included, and they doesn't mean they're going to cross the blood-brain barrier. So we have to think about this as a much more complex system than we have thought in the past, right? So what we've done is to approach something by trying to stop the enzyme that was wrong. And DFMO was one way to do it. Now, DFMO is a very interesting compound because it can be repurposed. It's a drug that was used years ago for cancer treatment. It has a very specific activity. It would be lovely if that drug would actually work in humans for Alzheimer's disease. It was never a really particularly good cancer treatment, but it certainly could be repurposed to turn to be a treatment for AD. Are we at that stage that I can say that this is going to be possible and happen and work? No. So we have to be what I would like to say cautiously optimistic.
Carol Colton is professor of neurology at Duke University and senior author of the new study on Alzheimer's disease. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Scientists have started trying to figure out why the Four Corners region is such a hot spot for methane. They earlier found the area to have one of the highest levels of methane in the world. For more on this, we turn to Christian Frankenberg. He's a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
We know it's one of the largest gas-producing area in the continental U.S., so that's an indication as to the sources itself, what is kind of emitting the methane in this area. And maybe I would also put this kind of huge methane into perspective a little bit, because in some ways it's visually maybe a little bit different, because this is one hotspot that's, if I may say so, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of somewhere where there are no other methane sources or industrialized areas surrounding it. So if you have a hotspot in these areas where you have relatively big methane emissions, it will be easier visible from space. And the satellites that we worked with that basically pinpointed to these areas, they also rely on techniques where we shouldn't have any local sources of CO2. So there are other mega cities like Los Angeles that emit more methane than the Four Corners area, but it's kind of hidden a little bit in the data. But the Four Corners area, of course, popped out nicely, and it's the biggest local anomaly that we could observe from space.
Will scientists be doing on-the-ground testing as well, in addition to the satellite work?
Yes, actually, we will have a multi-tiered approach to this campaign. It's a unique set that we have there with measurements ranging from the ground, from a van, basically, up to the satellite, with all the steps in between. And we hope that this is an ideal test case to actually show how we can tackle the methane problem. Because in a way, it's kind of the stepchild of greenhouse gases, but it might be the one that we can get more easily under control.
So what is your hypothesis at this point as to why this hotspot is there?
The main hypothesis is that it is related to the gas extraction in this area. Of course, this is kind of a little bit the elephant in the room. We know that it won't be cattle in this area. It won't be the sheep that are in this area. But because it is producing so much methane in this area, it's also not a huge fraction of it that needs to kind of leak to be able to explain the amount of methane that we observed there. Where exactly what facilities are emitting, whether it's kind of partially natural seepage or really just from like anthropogenic emissions in a way that facilities are mostly emitting, that's kind of really the thing that we need to investigate.
Is it a problem that there's all this methane out over the Four Corners? I mean, should people, for example, in the Phoenix area be concerned about this? I mean, should people just be careful not to go, like, light a match up in that area?
No. These are concentrations that are not really that high that you have to be worried about, like, lighting a match there. The methane is a long-lived greenhouse gas. So once it's emitted into the atmosphere, it can stay there for, like, on average 9 years. So typically whatever happens somewhere, you will see these methane molecules blown around the planet and they end up anywhere in the world, basically. But that also means typically for these greenhouse gases that are so well mixed, if you have a larger area that's emitting, we see them as enhancement, but it's not the same as, say, air pollutants like ozone or nitrogen dioxide, where you suddenly see in the city concentrations that are like 10 times or 100 times higher than in background areas. For methane, it's more like 5%, 10% higher.
Christian Frankenberg is a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Christian, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Do you ever feel like your world is in slow motion, that either thoughts or movements aren't coming quite as quickly as you'd expect? Well, according to a team of astronomers led by the University of Arizona's Peter Milne, that could also describe the expansion of the universe since the Big Bang. It's simply not accelerating at the rate that researchers had previously thought. Peter Milne says it has a lot to do with what his crew learned about supernovae.
People used to think that the ultraviolet emission from these supernovae was kind of had a lot of kind of randomness and scatter, and you wanted to avoid it. But we've recognized patterns within that ultraviolet emission, so we can separate those supernovae into two groups, a red group and a blue group. So the blue group's ultraviolet bright compared to the red group. You can see ultraviolet light from really far away supernovae if you use really big telescopes here on Earth. Things that are far away from us get redshifted. Ultraviolet light, as it leaves the supernova, can get shifted into the optical where it can make it to the atmosphere, and we can see it with the 8-meter telescopes. Close by, there's more red supernovae than blue ones. It's like 2-to-1 red, two reds for every blue. But if you look far away, they're mostly blues.
So in the most practical sense, how did that lead to learning more about the acceleration of the universe's expansion?
So over the course of distance, and thus looking back in time, you're actually not looking at the same exact group of supernovae as you go farther away in distance. That's a problem, because one of the basic assumptions when we use supernovae to measure distances is that the ones you're looking at close by that you're able to, like, calibrate, like figure out exactly how bright they are the same as the ones that you're looking at that are really far away. We've noticed this difference is pretty apparent in the ultraviolet, but it's only a subtle difference in the visible light. But there is a difference. So the last thing is that these blue supernovae are also a little bit blue in the visible. When you're using how bright something is to measure its distance, one of the other things that can confuse things is if there's dust blocking out some of the light. And so dust tends to make the light redder, but if the faraway supernovae are starting bluer than anybody thought they were, there could be more dust blocking out light than people realize. And so the studies maybe underestimated how much dust there was, and then said, oh, these supernovae are faint, so that must mean an accelerating universe. We're saying, well, maybe some of that accelerating universe isn't accelerating at all. It's dust that you haven't accounted for by not realizing that there's these red and blue groups.
Okay. You're saying the acceleration is still in effect. It's just slower than people expected. And on top of that, what does the slower acceleration then mean in terms of what we've assumed about the universe?
In answer to the first question, yes, the acceleration is still there. It seems that what we have found will eventually lead to is that there's not as much acceleration as might have been thought at first. So this is just kind of an adjustment of the number.
Well, Peter, let's ask the where do we come from then. So how old is the universe, and how, does this change at all how we should be measuring that?
This would make a little bit of a change, but we can't put numbers on how much this change would be. So at this point, we still kind of go with what people are already saying about the age of the universe. So we're not really advertising a change to the age of the universe at this point.
University of Arizona astronomer Peter Milne. He led the team that has determined the universe is not accelerating at the rate that researchers had previously thought.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing Steak Lovers, with a selection of USDA Prime and USDA Choice steaks, including filet mignon, ribeyes, and New York strips. 10 Valley locations can be found at AJsFineFoods.com.
The Arizona Latino Arts and Cultural Center in Phoenix is hosting a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian called American Sabor, Latinos in U.S. Popular Music. It opened last week and explores the way Latinos have influenced and shaped American musical culture. Shannon Dudley is an ethnomusicologist at the University of Washington and one of the exhibit's co-curators.
So often, American musical culture is sort of represented, popular musical culture is represented as a mixture of African-American and European-American traditions and musicians. So our purpose with this exhibit is to complicate that story and to bring Latinos into that story. And what we did in the exhibit was to organize it in terms of five cities that have been important centers of Latino musical production: New York, Miami, San Antonio, Los Angeles, and San Francisco.
It sounds like this isn't just an exhibit about Latino music, but more of where Latino music fits in sort of with the overall scheme of popular music.
Well, it's an exhibit about Latino music, but I think a lot of people don't think of hip-hop as a Latino music, right? So we're trying to change that perspective of what is Latino music to some extent. But I think also it is about putting American popular music, that is U.S. popular music, into a broader perspective and showing how it has connected to Latin American music and Latin American musicians and cultures.
In your mind, is there a golden age or a time that is particularly sort of people look back on fondly for Latino music?
Well, when you say Latin music as opposed to Latino music, a lot of people think of the 1950s and the mambo bands like Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez, Panchito, and the famous dance halls like the Palladium Ballroom in New York City, where a lot of non-Latinos as well as Latinos got turned on to Latin dancing. But one of the things that American Sabor shows is that there's something innovative and exciting happening in almost every decade somewhere in the country in Latino culture. In the 1970s, you have salsa music and hip-hop both happening in New York at the same time with a lot of Latino participation. In the 1980s, the Tejano scene becomes very vibrant and begins to project across the border and find Mexican listeners and really give a voice to Tejano musicians. In the 1990s, there's an incredibly vibrant Chicano rock scene in Los Angeles, and a lot of people organizing in a kind of do-it-yourself way to strengthen their communities and working both in the mainstream and winning Grammys, but also doing a lot of community work. So there are golden ages of different kinds, I guess, at different times and in different places. And maybe American Sabor can, for those people who sort of focus on the 50s and the big Latin bands like Tito Puentes as a golden age, they can see that there are so many other things that have happened since then and that have been very important to the communities in which they happen and had a big impact outside as well.
Shannon Dudley is an ethnomusicologist at the University of Washington and one of the co-curators of American Sabor. It'll be here in town through July. Shannon, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I hope everyone enjoys the exhibit.
And now a piece of American pop culture that probably appealed to a slightly different demographic.
For millions, that was the sound of Saturday Nights, back when the Golden Girls was primetime TV. The beloved buddy comedy about four feisty female senior citizens ran on NBC from 1985 to 1992. But it lives on, at least here in the Valley. KJZZ's Stina Sieg explains.
And we are recording! Yay! Thank you, everyone, for listening to Thank You for Being a Podcast.
Thank you for being a podcast with comedians Anthony DeSimito, the guy you're hearing right now, and Genevieve Rice, plus weekly guests like local authors and other comics. They watch an episode of The Golden Girls.
And then we break it down scene by scene because we opened up the Pandora's box and now we're going to write that demon out.
That's from the most recent podcast, Delving In to Take Him, He's Mine, also known as Season 2, Episode 3. Full disclosure, I can be heard a bit on this one while I was working on this story. DeSimito and Rice have been deconstructing episodes in order for 6 months. Needless to say, they know Dorothy, Blanche, Rose, and Sophia better than ever before.
How they date, how they eat, how they...
Oh, we know all their clothes.
All their clothes.
Yeah, like, we'll be like, oh, Dorothy's wearing that sweater again.
And that sweater is probably a loud turquoise with shoulder pads worn with big, garish earrings. That's the thing about the Golden Girls, which started 30 years ago. It's easy to laugh about the dated elements.
Yeah, we can make fun of it, but overall, it's a good show, and the writing is impeccable on it.
The writing and the acting. The acting is really great, and that's something I didn't really pick up on, you know, as a child.
And she probably didn't pick up on all the spicy humor, either.
You know what they're doing.
Yeah, I also know Stan. We were married for 38 years, and if you added up all the times that we did what he is doing right now, Blanche still should have been home 15 minutes ago.
Genevieve Rice and Anthony DeSimito say they chose The Golden Girls because they love it. And as comedians, they wanted to study the show's structure. But for DeSimito, it's also a personal thing. He was born in the U.S., but raised in Mexico. At 8, he came to Arizona with his family and started learning English, thanks in part to watching The Golden Girls with closed captioning.
VR, they taught me English. Yes, I watch it and I just feel like I'm back in that trailer in Yuma.
But don't think this podcast is all about nostalgia. The language can be rough, and like the show it celebrates, can be deeply sarcastic.
Rose, let me give you a few lessons in economics. Lesson number one, quit being an idiot.
She didn't want a business partner, she wanted a minion. Really.
She's a cult leader. She's a
That's the voice of local comic James Mabry, a recent guest. Things can get a little strange on the podcast, but maybe that's what's helped it gain traction with fans and guests. DeSimito says he and Rice plan to dissect all 7 seasons of the sitcom.
It's weird because if we don't do the podcast like one weekend, because we'll double up sometimes, I'll just feel really awkward, like something is missing.
Like B. Arthur, Betty White, Rue McClanahan, and Estelle Getty. So far, Thank You for Being a Podcast has been downloaded nearly 4,000 times. New episodes drop every Wednesday. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Grab some popcorn, candy, and call dibs on the remote.
Dibs.
Okay, it's time for a movie.
But not on Netflix. We're watching Sproutflix. It's a collection of short films exclusively featuring people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD.
Right. On Netflix, you can catch a movie like Rain Man, where Dustin Hoffman plays an autistic savant. But Sprout Films allow people who have IDD in real life to take the spotlight. And now, for the first time, the Sprout Film Festival is coming to Arizona.
John Myers is executive director of the ARC of Arizona, the organization hosting the festival. He says he gives full credit to actors like Hoffman, Cuba Gooding Jr., and Sean Penn for their portrayals of people with IDD.
But what they don't convey is the reality of the lives of these individuals. These actors with with disabilities are tremendous, and I think they have an even greater emotional effect on us.
And the intent of all the films is to, in some way, dispel stereotypes about people with IDD. They do it with comedy, like in the film I Love Grilled Cheese.
Maxwell, can you say, I love Libby?
Love, I love grilled cheese.
And there's romance in the film Sherry and Paul.
I went over to him, yes. I would like to go out with me. And he said, yes.
So she asked me, that's how this worked.
And don't forget action.
Now entering the room, Garrett Hollow.
The film Garrett's Fight documents the journey of 23-year-old Garrett Hollow, who wants to become an MMA fighter.
How does Down syndrome affect you?
It does not.
Hollow says he just ignores his Down syndrome, even though there were many people who felt someone with Down syndrome shouldn't be allowed in the ring.
But Meyer says Garrett has an advantage.
He didn't feel any fear. And, you know, maybe one of the things that sometimes holds us back in life is that we fear the consequences. We fear taking responsibility for those consequences ourselves.
It's not just about the hardships of having IDD. Myers says the films are a celebration of accomplishments and a reflection on the real lives of people with IDD.
The Sprout Film Festival will have an afternoon and evening showing on ASU's West Campus tomorrow. You can find more details online, theshow.kjzz.org. And be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. A Valley Museum celebrates an anniversary and how the drought is affecting lobbying. Those stories and much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
And if you're looking for something to do tonight, you can see legendary folk singer Judy Collins at 7:30 at the MIM in Phoenix.
You can also do the Tempe Adventure Run. That's this evening at Roadrunner Sports in Tempe.
Also, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus live. That's tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center.
And He Said, She Said will be performing tonight at the Lounge at Harrah's Ak-Chin Casino.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Schott, and Maria Springs are our digital team. The news director, Al Macias, the executive producer, is John Hogan.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. Tell us what you think about the show, good, bad, or ugly. You can email us at theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Starring Soledad Barrios, Spain's Noche Flamenca dance troupe performs fiery foot-stomping flamenco, April 24th and 25th. Tickets at scottsdaleperformingarts.org.